Marlins Hot Stove Show with Glenn Geffner is on.
Tyson fires, Morneau swings, loops one into center field, out goes Etch, a long way out, he dives and makes the catch to save the night.
940 wins.
How about that for thrills?
Miami Sports.
Hey, hello again, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Marlins Hot Stove, where I promise there will be no discussion of deflated footballs over the next 2 hours tonight. As we begin the final week of January, here we sit now inside a month from the start of spring training. The first pitchers and catchers workouts coming up on February 20th, the day before the Marlins host their annual winter warm-up at Marlins Park on Saturday, February 21st. And it all begins again. Opening day against the Braves exactly 10 weeks from today. So our time huddled around the hot stove this winter is dwindling. And with that in mind, we have a lot planned for you here tonight on the show. In addition to the latest news and notes from across the major leagues, coming up momentarily, I'll talk live with Marlins pitching coach Chuck Hernandez. I want to ask Chuck to run us through the process by which he gets the staff ready for the start of the season over the course of the spring. Among many other things, we'll also talk about Jose Fernandez and the challenges he may face on the road back from Tommy John surgery. In our second hour, we're going to talk with first baseman Justin Bour, who we saw make his major league debut with the Marlins in 2014. He'll head to Jupiter looking to earn a spot coming off the bench. He had a very interesting offseason. And we'll talk to Justin Bour about that tonight as well. Kyle Seeloff has a fascinating conversation tonight with a longtime big league umpire, current MLB umpiring observer Steve Ripley. The truth is, we don't know a whole lot about the day-to-day life of a big league umpire. Steve Ripley offers up some great insight when he sits down with Kyle coming up later in our program tonight. Got to continue our series looking at the Marlins competition in the National League East. Tonight I'm going to talk with Dave Jagler, one of the radio play-by-play voices of the Washington Nationals, with Max Scherzer now signed, sealed, and delivered. The Nats remain the team to beat in the division. We'll get the latest on the defending National League East Division champs from Dave. And as the night goes on, I want to talk a little bit, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on a couple of issues that have been getting a lot of attention in baseball circles of late. Time of game, picking up the pace a little bit, or maybe a lot. We know from all he said on the topic, it's a priority for new commissioner Rob Manfred. I've got some thoughts based on an online poll I did and the conversation inspired on Twitter and Facebook in recent days. I know many of you have some thoughts as well. So the question of how important a priority speeding up times of game ought to be, as well as the new commissioner's comments on possibly banning infield shifts. We'll get to that later in the program here tonight as well. Want to turn our focus, though, to our first guest of the evening before we get too far into the night tonight. We're going to be getting started momentarily with Chuck Hernandez, the Marlins pitching coach, who's heading into his third year at the helm here. And what a job Chuck has done. You know, there was deservedly a lot of talk a season ago about how much the Marlins improved offensively from 2013 to 2014. And with the additions of Michael Morse, D. Gordon, and Martin Prado to the lineup, they should make another sizable jump here in 2015. I'm not sure, though, there was as much discussion as there should have been about what the Marlins accomplished on the mound this past season. After setting a club ERA record in 2013, the Marlins posted their second-best ERA ever in 2014, and that's even with Jose Fernandez going down in May. Marlins bullpen set a club ERA record for the second consecutive season. The staff walked fewer batters than in any season in franchise history, and at the same time, Marlins pitching staff posted its third-best single-season strikeout total. The man who directs that staff, Chuck Hernandez, will be joining us coming up here, hopefully, in the next few minutes, going to talk some pitching with Chuck Hernandez, who has an exciting staff to look forward to working with here in 2014. At some point, we know we're going to get Jose Fernandez back, but let's put Jose Fernandez aside. You think about a rotation headed by Henderson Alvarez coming off the All-Star season a year ago. You think about Matt Latos joining this team from the Cincinnati Reds, coming over in the deal this winter. You've got a rotation that also will include a full season of Jared Cozart, who was terrific for the Marlins. Jared, who was on this show a week ago, did a great job coming over from the Houston Astros at the trading deadline last year and really helped carry the starting rotation the rest of the way. Potentially Dan Herron, still in hurry-up-and-wait mode as far as Dan Herron is concerned, but if Dan Herron's going to be part of this staff, as we hope he will be after being acquired from the Dodgers, Herron, a guy who has been a perennial 13, 14, 15-game winner, perennially right around 200 innings pitched, a guy you can really count on for big innings, a lot of quality innings over the course there. He's a nice addition to the rotation. And then you've got Tom Kohler, who was my guest on this show a couple of weeks ago. TK coming off his first full season in a big league rotation, made every start over the course of the full season. He's still growing, still improving, so looking forward to seeing what that rotation can do, what the bullpen can do, led by Steve Cishek, who incidentally was back home. Remember, he's a Falmouth, Mass native, a Cape Cod guy, Steve Cishek, and he was up in Boston just a couple of nights ago. He was honored by the Boston chapter of the Baseball Writers Association of America. Boston, one of the handful of cities in this country that still has a big, big annual baseball writers dinner every winter. St. Louis still does it. New York still does it. The New York event, which was just held over the weekend, is where they present the MVP, the Cy Young, the Rookie of the Year Award, the Manager of the Year Award every year. The Boston Dinner is a huge event every year, and Cishek was invited up to be honored as their New England Major League Player of the Year in 2014. So Cishek coming off the big season as the Marlins closer anchors that bullpen this year. You look at Mike Dunn, you look at A.J. Ramos, you look at the job that we saw Sam Dyson do for the Marlins a season ago. A lot of growth. Carter Capps, a big arm we saw for the Marlins last year, who had some injury problems. Didn't pitch as much as they would have liked to have seen him throw a season ago, but a big arm, 100-mile-per-hour fastball, a guy the Marlins are going to be counting on in 2015 to help anchor that bullpen, along with some newcomers, Aaron Crow, who comes over from the Kansas City Royals, most likely be in that bullpen. Some other arms we'll talk about over the course of the rest of this evening. We'll get to Chuck Hernandez, and we'll talk about over the course of the remainder of our programs here between now and the start of spring training. It really is hard to believe that the beginning of spring training is just right around the corner, February 20th, the first pitchers and catchers workout. The very next day is the Marlins winter warm-up at Marlins Park, Saturday, February 21st. Want to make sure you're out there. You can bring the family out to the ballpark for a full day of fun, be able to purchase single-game tickets for the 2015 season for the first time. Select your seats for season tickets and mini plans. Get autographs from Marlins players and alumni. You'll enjoy games, activities, music, and entertainment for all ages. Don't miss Marlins winter warm-up coming up on Saturday, February 21st at Marlins Park. For more information, go to marlins.com. Always a great day. I would expect we'll be broadcasting live from the event. Virtually every single Marlins player is at that event every year. If you like pictures, if you like autographs, that's the day to get out there. And if you want to make sure you're there for opening day against the Braves on April 6th, if you want to make sure you're at the ballpark with tickets when the Yankees come to town this year, when the Boston Red Sox come to town this year, you'll want to be at winter warm-up and get those single-game tickets when they go on sale. A lot of exciting dates when you look ahead at that 2015 schedule. You know, I'm not a guy who usually looks too far ahead at this schedule, but as we have now approached the end of January and spring training is right around the corner, I've begun to kind of look at that schedule a little bit more, and you see it all coming to life in the early matchups within the division against the Braves, the Nationals, the Mets, and the Phillies. It'll be a good test early on and a good barometer early on to see where the Marlins may stand as they try to continue their climb up the National League East Division standings. Remember, after three straight last-place finishes, the Marlins able to slip ahead of the Phillies this past season and hoping to leapfrog some more people here in 2015 with all the additions they've made this winter. The Marlins certainly, you would expect, have their work cut out for them, as everybody in baseball, it would seem, has their work cut out for them in trying to match up one-on-one with those Washington Nationals, who seem to be the class of the NL East, the class of the National League, maybe the class of all of baseball, particularly after adding Max Scherzer to the fold last week. But we'll see. As Miami tries to make a run at those Nats, we'll see them a lot early on at home and on the road. We will see how the Marlins and the Mets match up in 2015. And the Braves, a team that's had an interesting offseason that we're going to find out about a little bit more. We'll have a Braves broadcaster or writer on the show over the course of the next couple of weeks to try to get an update on Atlanta and see what's going on with those Braves. Where are the Braves? Because right now, most people think that you've got the Nationals, the Marlins, and the Mets all having pulled ahead of Atlanta in this National League East. The Phillies, a team that most project will bring up the rear in the division with the moves that they've made to begin to rebuild a little bit. Still a veteran team, still some players on the backside of their career, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in Philadelphia here in 2015 moving forward. Maybe the Phillies aren't done. We'll see. Speculation a couple of days ago that Jonathan Papelbon might have been on his way to the Milwaukee Brewers. Apparently those talks have fallen through, but the Phillies, who've already traded Marlon Byrd away this winter, potentially on the verge of trading Jonathan Papelbon. They dealt their shortstop Jimmy Rollins to the Dodgers. They've been busy, and we'll see how it all plays out in what ought to be a very interesting race in the National League East here in 2015. Before we go any further, though, I want to turn to our first guest of the night. I want to welcome the Marlins pitching coach, Chuck Hernandez, to the show. Chuck, thanks for joining us tonight.
I'm good, Glenn. How are you? Nice to talk to you.
I'm doing great. Hey, it won't be long before everybody's back together up in Jupiter. I know you've been in this game a long time. I think this spring marks 30 years since you began coaching in the minor leagues with the White Sox back in 85. Can you talk a little bit about how different things are today as opposed to 15 or 20 years ago in terms of the condition pitchers are in when they arrive at spring training?
Truthfully, it's not that much different. Guys are 20 years ago, they were already coming in shape. You know, you'd probably have to go back a little farther than that, you know, before the days when, you know, guys used to work in the off season and whatnot, and then they'd come into spring training and work their way into shape. But for the last 20 years, as long as I've been doing, you're making it sound like I've done this way too long. Not that long, Glenn, all right?
You got a great resume.
Well, the guys are, you know, generally, you know, good pros. They know how to take care of themselves. They know how to get ready for spring training, and, you know, and they, you know, a lot of that has been taught, you know, through, in their minor league careers too, you know, coming in camp, getting ready to go. So, I wasn't around the era where I know guys used to come in, you know, 15 pounds overweight and put on rubber suits and run and work their way into shape.
And they really needed spring training at one time. Right now, it's a little bit different. We, in talking about the preparation pitchers do in the winter, over the last couple of weeks, you've had Tom Kohler, Steve Cishek, and Jared Cozart all on the show, and they've talked about the work that they've been doing to get ready for the start of the spring. How much contact do you have with members of the staff in the winter, and how involved are you in helping guys put together their off-season routines?
Well, mostly we talk about off-season routines, you know, at the end of the year. And you know, I'm not of the belief that, you know, everyone's going to do it exactly the same. You know, I know that most guys that have played for, you know, a few years now have, you know, put together an off-season program that kind of works for them. As far as the contact, I mean, you know, we stay in very little contact, mild contact, you know, because let's face it, we're eight months together every day. So, you know, they probably don't want to hear me getting on them for a few months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just kind of gives everybody a fresh break. And you know, so when we come to spring training, we're all happy and anxious to see each other. But, you know, just we check in just to make sure everyone's doing fine. And our training staff and Ty, our strength coach, they stay on top of everybody. And we know of any, you know, any problems or injuries or anything that could occur or anything that's not feeling right in the off season. You know, we got a good handle on all those types of things. But mostly for all the healthy guys that are going through their normal off season, you know, it's kind of their time to get ready the way that they feel they need to.
Talking with Marlins pitching coach Chuck Hernandez. Chuck, once they get to Jupiter, can you walk us through the progression your starters generally go through from the time they throw their first bullpen session through the end of the spring? How you build them up for opening day?
Well, generally, most guys, when they come in, guys range, you know, some guys throw a little bit more, some guys like a little less. But, you know, they've probably already thrown anywhere from 6 to 10 bullpen on their own. If that's totally normal, healthy guy. You know, there's no problems, nothing that they had to wait a little bit of time to get throwing their throwing programs in January. But, you know, basically it starts in January and ended December. You know, guys are starting to play catch and then turns that into long toss. And then, you know, it's a bullpen or a week. And then it's a couple bullpens a week. And as they get close, then they'll throw two or three bullpens, you know, the week before we start up with camp. Then once we get to camp, our normal progression is we probably have four more bullpens, you know, under supervision. And it's always a little different, you know, than what you're doing at home, you know, because there's a lot of eyes on you. And it's just the nature of what goes on. And then from there we progress to, you know, a batting practice session and then simulated game, you know, and then we're right into games, you know, and we usually use a, you know, a guideline of about 15 pitches, and we usually start starters, you know, with two innings and 30-ish pitches, and, you know, and then we kind of progress an inning and 15 pitches at a time all the way towards the end of camp where it builds them up to about 100-pitch limit.
You're going to have some new faces on the staff this spring. Matt Latos, potentially Dan Heron, maybe David Phelps in the rotation, Aaron Crow, potentially some others in the bullpen. What's the process like for you in getting to know the newcomers?
Well, it's, you know, it's the same as always. You know, we're studying some of their films, you know, and seeing what's made them tick and what's made them good over their times throughout their career. But mostly it's you know, building a relationship, you know, getting to know each other, getting to know, you know, how we can help them and what they need in terms of what, you know, keeps them on track and all those types of things. So, you know, especially with Dan, who's been around a long time, Heron, you know, he's pretty much knows what he needs to do, and it's just a matter of us keeping things in order for him, you know. So the more you play, it's to me, it's the most important thing. Spring training is to just start to build a little trust and a little relationship, to know that we're there to help them, and we're there to do anything we can to make them as successful as they can be.
Before we get to some of the individuals in this staff, we saw a 20-second pitch clock introduced in Arizona Fall League this offseason. Last week they made the announcement that the pitch clock would be implemented in AA and AAA this season. From the perspective of a big league pitching coach, you have any thoughts on the possibility of a timed pitch clock coming to the big leagues at some point?
Well, I think it will. I think they're not doing it for you know, they're not doing it just to practice. I think it's going to happen at some point. And I'm fine with it because I'm a big proponent of, you know, throwing strikes and working fast. That's two of my starting statements, you know, throw strikes and work fast. Mm-hmm. That way, if you're not too good tonight, we don't have to watch it for too long and we can move on. So I mean, it really doesn't bother me. And you know, by and large, most guys pretty much work within that parameter anyhow. We've always had a kind of a fake watch anyway, but only if a guy's really deliberate. You know, every once in a while, one of the umpires come by the dugout and say, hey, Chuck, man, tell him to pick it up or that kind of thing. But for the most part, you know, most guys like to get it and throw it. And, you know, sometimes the more you think, the more chance you have to work yourself in the slump. So, you know, catch it, throw it, let's get on to the next pitch.
It's interesting that that's your perspective, because most of the fans I talk to don't like it. Most of the media doesn't seem to like it. And here's a big league pitching coach thinks it's a good idea. You think most of your pitchers and most of the pitchers you know would agree?
Yeah, I think they do.
That's interesting.
For the most part. I mean, 22 seconds is not as quick as people think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they probably have never sat there. I've sat there and, you know, have guys throwing within 17, 18 seconds all the time.
You know?
So it's not really something that's unusual. You know, I mean, like I said, I think there's the occasional guys that are very deliberate, and I think they're just trying to clean that up.
We're talking with the Marlins pitching coach, Chuck Hernandez. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, want to ask Chuck about Jose Fernandez, about some of the other pitchers on the staff as well. So stay with us. It is Marlins Hot Stove, last week of January. Spring training right around the corner. More baseball talk right after this on 940 Wins.
Baseball's hot stove season is here. The Marlins' Glenn Geffner is on 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Taking you up until 9 o'clock tonight, as we do every Monday night, talking Marlins baseball, talking Major League Hot Stove. I'll get right back to the Marlins pitching coach, Chuck Hernandez, our leadoff guest here tonight. Chuck, I know he's not expected back until June or July, but I still get more questions about Jose Fernandez than anybody. I bet you do as well. What's the latest you're hearing on the progress of his rehab?
Well, he's doing great. I just talked to him the other day, and, you know, in Jose's spirit, and as we would all expect, he told me he's never felt better in his life. So we're thankful for that. And, you know, he's going along his work. He's not overworking, which is going to be key to us making sure he doesn't do. But everything so far points to, a good, healthy return.
Now, you've been around a lot of pitchers coming back from Tommy John surgery over the years. In your experience, what are the biggest challenges you think Jose is going to face when he comes back?
Well, I think, you know, number one, it's when you get to heavy reps. You know, generally, everyone feels pretty good early on, you know, when you've given enough time and followed the proper protocol. But as you start getting into your heavy rep load, that's when you start to, you know, notice that, wow, my arms, you know, I got to get it back in shape. Because it's not the same, you know. Not the same for him. He's never gone, you know, 9-10 months without picking up a baseball in his life. So, you know, once you get to where you're throwing, you know, every other day and you're adding your reps, then you'll, you know, he's going to probably have more, you know, sorenesses in other parts of his arm, you know, and your shoulder gets a little more sore, the back of your shoulders, your scaps, you know, just things like that, which are all minor and it's normal and you're going to go through it, but that's generally when you know that, I have been through something and I gotta just keep plugging along.
John Smoltz just became the first pitcher to survive Tommy John surgery and earn election to the Hall of Fame. I saw a piece in one of the New York papers in which he was asked what advice he would give to Matt Harvey, just like Jose, a young phenom coming back from Tommy John surgery. Everybody's different, and you got to start by saying that everybody is different, but he said that for him, the biggest thing after the surgery was coming to understand that he didn't have to live in the upper 90s with his fastball. He said the surgery helped him find what he called a cruising speed. and it helped him become more of a complete pitcher moving forward. He saved the all-out gas for when he needed in a tight spot, maybe occasionally late in a ball game. He said that was really important for him in staying healthy and productive over the long haul. Again, I come back to where I started. Every pitcher is different. But do you think any of that could ring true with Jose?
Well, I think Jose has a very, workable pitch range where when he's throwing the ball, he is comfortable. And that was one of the most impressive things of all to me, in his rookie year and in the beginning of last year, was that he didn't have to reach back for, every bit of fastball he has to pitch. Now, what he did learn, though, is at times he would try to do that, and it wasn't usually in a jam or something like that. It might be a certain hitter that's up or just something about the situation would make him, want to overthrow, which a lot of young guys do for a lot of the early part of their career. So, I think that might govern that down on him a little bit and let him understand. But, by and large, he could not accomplish the things he did at that young of an age had he been out there overthrowing a lot. You know what I mean? It's just he just wouldn't have been able to pitch as efficiently and as clean as we saw, what he was able to do. So I don't think that's going to be his biggest issue. I think, again, his issue would just be just the normalcy of getting back in the routine and getting all of the arm back in shape and being in major league ready condition again.
Even with Jose going down in May, I mentioned before you came on, Chuck, that 2014 was a very good year for this pitching staff in many respects. You had set a club ERA record in 2013, last year the second-best ERA in franchise history, even without Jose most of the year. The bullpen set a club ERA record for the second straight year. Fewer walks allowed than in any full season in franchise history as a staff. The third-best single-season strikeout total in franchise history. So a lot was accomplished even without Jose. And I want to ask you about a couple other pitchers on the staff, and begin with Henderson Alvarez, who gets so much attention for his style, for the flair on the mound, the fun it looks like he's having out there. But I hate for that to overshadow the success he's had, and particularly what he did a season ago. He really stepped up in Jose's absence, sixth in the league in ERA, strikeouts up, walks done, almost 200 innings. Where did you see Henderson improve from 2013 to 2014?
Well, just basically from all aspects of the game, starting with, with his maturity. And you know what? I like Hendu being Hendu. I don't try to knock him down. Some of his flair, his pre-pitch routine, at times I know he might ruffle some feathers from the other side, but you know what? That makes him tick a little bit, and I'm fine with it. So I got no problem with that. But just I thought his work ethic from start to finish was much more mature. The emergence of his changeup became a weapon. Coming from Toronto, I'd heard that he had a pretty good changeup. And truthfully, in the first season together, it was in and out. It wasn't very consistent. But last year, changeup really took a step forward, and he went to it in crucial situations where the year before he was more reluctant in jams and those types of spots, to go to his secondary stuff, And also the emergence of his breaking ball has gotten better, too. He's got a workable breaking ball that, suits him. It doesn't bother his arm like what he was throwing, a couple years back. So he's found some things out about himself, and he was hungry to improve and to show people that he's a top flight pitcher.
Final few minutes with Marlins pitching coach Chuck Hernandez. I want to ask you about Tom Kohler. Like Alvarez, almost 200 innings last year. He took the ball every 5 days. He made every single start from April through September. For any pitcher who's still getting his feet wet in the big leagues, how big a hurdle is that to clear for the first time? 30-plus starts and about 200 innings.
Well, that's a huge hurdle. I thought he made great progress last year. He started to become a very consistent type guy. I know, like most young guys in the previous year to that, there'd be some up and down with Tommy. And with all pitchers, you have some moments of up and down. But I thought, by and large, from start to finish, he gave us a chance to win a lot of games when he went out there. So I think his confidence grew a great deal. I think he's feeling good about Tommy Kohler, and I'm excited to see what's in store for him next. There's still some more ceiling for us to reach. And I really believe that he has the makeup, the work ethic, and the toughness to still get some good things accomplished.
Give me
into the season.
Give me another name or two of pitchers who excite you in the staff. Guys who you saw making strides down
all
the stretch line.
All of them. I'm so excited about
guys ready to make a jump.
I'm ready to go tomorrow. Let's start tomorrow because, you know, our front office, first a commitment, you know, from Jeffrey Loria all the way to Mike Hill and the whole staff and Dan Jennings and all the guys up front. I think that we had a marvelous off season, which absolutely means nothing until we get out and we blend a team, get the camaraderie right, get the work ethic right, and get all the focus on where it needs to be, and that's winning, you know, one baseball game at a time. But I mean, the excitement of the whole thing to me is you know, it's just to think where we were just 2 years ago and 2 years later, you know, the kind of talent, the kind of players we have, you know, to work with. So, you know, it's going to be our job as the coaches and players to, you know, put together some things that the front office has done a great job putting together for us. So we're looking forward to it all. But I didn't answer your question. I'm excited about all the pitchers, Steve Cishek, Mike Dunn, A.J. Ross. We got a lot of good arms. We got a lot of good guys. That I think try to do things the right way. And, you know, sooner or later, we're going to be rewarded for that.
That's a great answer. You did answer my question. I appreciate it. Hey, the goal is to get to October. And if you watch the postseason, if you watch it in 2014, if you watch it every year, you know it all begins with the pitching. The teams that get
That's
deep
right.
into October have great pitching staffs. Chuck, this staff's made huge strides over the couple of years you've been here already. Looking forward to a big 2015.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it, and I really didn't realize any of those stats you were throwing out because I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in individual improvements, but we need to pitch better. How's that? Pitch better this year to get farther. We'll leave it with that.
Hey, 15 more wins in 2014 than in 2013. That's the ultimate stat that matters the most, and hopefully 15 more this year, and you're in great shape come October.
We're going to try to win the first game. That's all we're going to do. Actually, we're going to get ready for the first day of spring training and try to get ourselves good and healthy and get guys well prepared to have a fine season and then play them one at a time and not worry about the big picture too much. And if we do that, we have the kind of players and talent around that, you know, might lead to some good times in Miami this summer. So everybody needs to come on out. Let's have some fun.
Let's have some fun. Chuck, we'll see you in Jupiter on the 20th. Thanks for the time tonight.
Okay, nice talking to y'all.
Take care. That's Chuck Hernandez, the Marlins pitching coach. Some great insight as we head into the spring. Spring training begins for pitchers and catchers on February 20th, right around the corner. Going to continue our look at the Marlins competition in the National League East Division. When we come back, going to preview the defending division champs, the Washington Nationals. Nats radio voice Dave Jagler joins me next, so stay with us on Marlins Hot Stove.
Keep your hand on the hot stove with the Marlins' Glenn Geffner. 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
With you until 9 o'clock tonight, talking baseball. And tonight we continue our Marlins Hot Stove series, looking at the Marlins' opponents in the National League East as we spend a few minutes talking about the defending division champions, the Washington Nationals. The Nats won a league-high 96 games a season ago. They cruised to the division title. They finished 17 games up on the Braves and the Mets, 19 ahead of the Marlins. As you may recall, we were in Washington to close out the season. To me, at that point, they looked like they had as good a chance as anybody, not only win a pennant, but maybe even a World Series championship, but they dropped 3 1-run games in a 4-game NLDS against the eventual champion Giants. It was a heartbreaking October finish for the second time in 3 years for the Nats. That series loss aside, this is a ball club that didn't have a whole lot of work to do heading into the winter. Not many holes to fill. Yet they got even better last week with the signing of free agent right-hander Max Scherzer. And joining me now to talk about Scherzer and the rest of these Nationals, one of their radio voices, Dave Jagler. Dave, thanks for taking some time tonight.
Hey, Glenn, good to be with you.
How's the weather up your way?
Well, just the old expression, batten down the hatches. The hatches are battened, and we're just kind of waiting.
All right.
Supposedly, you're going to get 18 to 20 inches here between 8 o'clock tonight and 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, and they're saying to be one of the top 5 storms on record in this area. So the Northeast is bracing. I live up in Rhode Island in the off season, so DC it was fortunate it kind of skirted by there today, but the Northeast it's really bearing down on them here right now.
So you're definitely ready to head down to Florida. Hey,
yeah, counting the days.
Before we look forward, I want to ask you about the way 2014 ended. We know anything can happen in a short series. We now know about the role the Giants got on in October. But still, the way the Nats were playing down the stretch, 19-8 in September, seeing things end as they did last year had to be incredibly tough to take.
Yeah, you know, Glenn, if I were commissioner for a day, you know, what I would do is I would, if the season ends on a Sunday, you've got to leave Monday for tiebreaker games and the wild card game on Tuesday. I would have the division series start on Wednesday. And looking back on it, we know it was a spectacular way to end the 10th season in Nationals baseball with their first ever no-hitter when Jordan Zimmermann no-hit the Marlins. But in a way that may have been bad for the big picture of the 2014 Nationals. It was such a high point and an emotional ending to the season that by the time the team reconvened and played on the Friday after 4 days off, they just never seemed to recapture the mojo, if you will, or the magic. So baseball players are creatures of habit. Sitting around for 4 days is never what anyone wants to sign up for. And, you know, everyone talks about trying to avoid the wild card game. Well, everyone wants to avoid the wild card game, but if you get in and you win it, the history has shown here in the couple of years that they've had this, that it's not a bad thing. I mean, both World Series representatives won the wild card game and knocked off the favorite in the division series with Kansas City sweeping the Angels and the Giants taking down the Nationals in four games. So I know it's an excuse now, and you know it works. Everyone wants to avoid that wild card game, and it's great for them to win a division. But that 4 day rest, I think, really hampered what they brought to the table in the DS because the offense just never clicked. The pitching was fine. They played a four game series, and in one of those games, it was an 18 inning game. So in essence, they played 5 innings of baseball, 45 innings, and they allowed 9 runs. Mm-hmm. That should be good enough to win. But they only scored 9 runs. And as you said, they dropped 3 one-run games, and the Giants just seemed to score the timely runs when it mattered.
As they did throughout the year and throughout October, and that's why they're running that trophy all around Northern California these days. Hey, let's turn the page to look ahead. Since the end of last season, the Nationals have lost Adam LaRoche as a free agent, but you move Ryan Zimmermann across the diamond to play first base. You've added the second baseman the club's been looking for in Yunel Escobar, although he cost you a terrific setup man in Tyler Clippard. And then Mike Rizzo made the huge splash last week, seemingly coming out of nowhere, to sign the biggest free agent pitching prize of the winner, Max Scherzer. Is there anything left for Rizzo and company to do before they head to Vieira?
Well, I mean, bullpen would be the issue. I mean, I think there was probably a parade in South Florida when Tyler Clippard was traded out of the division. I mean, he always had his best numbers against the Marlins. I don't know if he ever gave up a run against Miami, seemingly, but that's a big hole because Clippard really locked down the eighth inning. In fact, as a Nationals fan, you felt better about the eighth inning than you did the ninth inning the last couple of years. But an eighth inning guy is kind of a luxury. I mean, a lot of teams use younger players or piecemeal the eighth inning. I mean, some guys have a dominant eighth inning guy, but that would be the area of concern going forward is how are they going to mix and match in the bullpen? They lost a lot of innings out of that bullpen with Rafael Soriano, who closed for most of the year, a free agent, and then Clippard being traded, and they also traded away Ross Detweiler. So they have lost over 180 innings out of last year's bullpen, and they're going to be counting on guys who are maybe untested or unproven or who aren't yet on the roster. Maybe there's another move to be made in that respect. So that's obviously a focus. And the other thing that losing LaRoche and trading for Escobar, there's maybe some concern about how he makes the adjustment to second base. He hasn't played there since 2007. And if you want to nitpick, the lineup is now predominantly right-handed. I mean, with LaRoche, they had terrific balance in the middle of the lineup, and no manager could match up more than a batter at a time because they would alternate left and right pretty much up and down the lineup. But now you have Denard Span as the leadoff hitter left-handed. Bryce Harper is the only left-handed power bat. And now your big-time power bats, be it Worth and Ryan Zimmerman and Anthony Rendon and Ian Desmond and Wilson Ramos are all right-handed. So that's one probably small area of concern. Can they add a left-handed bat, be it off the bench, before the season starts?
Talking about the Washington Nationals with one of the radio voices, Dave Jagler. We have seen speculation since Scherzer signed that the Nats could be open to trading Jordan Zimmermann or Doug Fister, who are both a year away from free agency. Even Steven Strasburg's name has been mentioned. He'll be a free agent in 2 years. As it stands right now, obviously the Nationals, the best rotation in baseball. Do you really see a scenario where any of those three are pitching somewhere else on opening day?
Well, I mean, the one thing about Mike Rizzo, the Nationals GM, he loves to have options. I mean, one of the reasons they traded for Yunel Escobar is Ian Desmond is another free agent to be after one more year. But if you were to try to trade Desmond now, or if Desmond plays out the year and leaves, you have a ready-made shortstop who you could slide back over to that position going forward. So he likes to protect himself. So, you know, right now some general manager can call up Mike Rizzo, and if you want to empty your farm system for one year of Jordan Zimmermann, then Mike Rizzo will make that trade. But he doesn't have to. And if Zimmermann and Pfister play out the year and leave, you still have Max Scherzer and Steven Strasburg and a host of young pitchers coming up from the minor leagues to fill in 2016, not to mention Tanner Roark, who won 15 games as a number five last year, right now is going to be a long man out of the bullpen. So I think the way they structured Scherzer's salary was the telling factor. If Max Scherzer was being paid, you know, obviously his contract is, what, 7 years, $210 million. That's an average of $30 million a year. If you were making, you know, $28 to $30 million this year, then yes, they'd have to make a trade of one of the big salary starting pitchers. But the fact that half of that money is deferred, in 2015 he's going to cost $15 million. The Nationals paid Dan Herron $13 million 2 years ago to be a number four starter. So I hate to say $15 million is a bargain, but for what Max Scherzer is going to bring to you, it certainly is for a potential number one starter. So financially, they can swing it without making a deal, and I'd like to see them do that. And how many teams have five starters make 32 starts apiece? I mean, the odds are someone's going to go down at some point, and you have a ready-made replacement, like I talked about. Mike Rizzo likes those options. Hey, you've got Tanner Roark right there on your pitching staff. If somebody goes down, he's right there to fill in.
You mentioned Ian Desmond's name. I want to get them for a second. We've seen the numbers he puts up year in and year out at a premium position. And I know in talking to folks around the club, what he means to that team and the clubhouse as a leader. A year away from free agency, how critical do you think it is they find a way to keep Ian Desmond for the long haul?
Boy, I mean, it's hard to imagine the Nationals without him. I mean, he was there when they were losing 100 games and just started to come up and has been there throughout the resurgence of this franchise. And it would be more than just the 20 homers, 20 steals, and the defense that he brings. It is that leadership. I mean, he's basically the captain, and he has been since he was a rookie, even not putting up great numbers. He acted like a team leader his very first year in the big leagues. So it'd be hard to see him leave, but if you believe the reports, Glenn, as to what he turned down, and the price tag is only going up with another Silver Slugger Award and another 2020 season at a position that doesn't have big-time power options. I mean, he's going to be the big-ticket item at that position if he hits the free agent market next year. So if they can't sign him before the season starts, and it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of momentum in that direction, the odds are he probably leaves. Mm. And again, I mentioned they have Escobar there, and they did make a kind of a small trade. It was a side piece to a three-way deal. I mean, a big deal that Will Myers shifted teams, but the third prong of that trade was the Nationals dealt Steven Sousa Jr., who made the catch to end the no-hitter against the Marlins, and picked up two premium prospects from the Padres in a three-way deal. One of those is a shortstop named Trey Turner, who can't even join the organization until June because he was drafted last June, and you have to stay with your current organization 1 year after being drafted. He's a guy who is a premium shortstop and potential leadoff hitter. So down the line, he would be a shortstop in waiting. So again, there are options if Desmond were to leave. But boy, it would be tough to replace him in the short term if he does depart after the season.
It's a big story to watch with this team in 2015, I think, because you've got several key players, Jordan Zimmermann, Doug Pfister, Ian Desmond, and Denard Span, all free agents after 2015. Then Strasburg, Drew Storen, Wilson Ramos a year behind. They'll be free agents after 2016. Mm-hmm. There's no way any team keeps everybody. And you've already traded Tyler Clippard, who's heading into his free agent year. But as somebody who's around this team every day, how do you think they go about prioritizing that group? Who's got to stay?
Well, I mean, the fact that they signed Scherzer, I think, protects them. I mean, the best-case scenario, I think Span is probably most likely to be gone. They have his replacement in-house, a young player named Michael Taylor. So if you look at the other three, and before the Nationals ever signed Max Scherzer, if you say, boy, you can re-sign one, you probably be doing pretty well. Well, the fact that you signed Scherzer protects you if you can't sign either starting pitcher back. If Zimmermann and Pfister both leave, then you have that number one still there. So I don't know that any of the three potentially are going to be back, but the fact that Scherzer, like I said, is at $15 million a year for the 7 years of his contract and then the 7 years beyond his contract, gives you the flexibility to potentially sign one of those guys. Now, Zimmerman, with what the numbers that he's put up, and I know it's a crowded free agent market, to me it seems like a no-brainer that the Cubs are going to go after him very hard, a Wisconsin kid, a local, you know, not far away there, or potentially the Brewers. I don't know if they have the finances to make it work, but the Cubs would pair him with John Lester. I mean, I think there's going to be heavy competition to re-sign Zimmerman. Maybe Pfister's the more likely guy that you hang on to because he's not going to quite cost you as much just because he's a few years older and doesn't quite have the cachet of the other guys simply because he doesn't strike people out. All he does is win and pitch effectively and have a great ERA, but he kind of gets lost in the shuffle when you look at the other big-name free agents, whether it's Johnny Cueto or David Price or Jordan Zimmerman. Pfister always seems like in that second tier of pitchers, but he performs like a first-tier pitcher.
Talking about the Washington Nationals, one of their radio voices, Dave Jagler. I wish we had more time. Before we let you go, Dave, I want to ask you about Bryce Harper. In some ways, it feels like he's been around forever, but he's going to play the entire season as a 22-year-old in 2015. The hype was so great, the expectations so high. We've seen flashes of brilliance, including in the playoffs against the Giants. He's also been hurt a lot. Are folks who've been critical of Harper's production to this point being a little bit unfair?
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, he brings some of that on himself. I mean, it always seems like the camera is following him, and obviously some things that he says and does rubs people the wrong way. But again, to look at what he has produced in his ages 19 through 21 season are pretty historic. Now, he hasn't had that breakout season yet that the hype would justify, but he will be a key piece this year because, as we discussed earlier, Adam LaRoche is gone, and this past season, Matt Williams, you know, Davey Johnson had always hit Harper high in the lineup. Matt Williams hit him sixth the majority of the year, but with LaRoche being gone, if you want to split up the right-handed bats, Harper's got to hit higher, potentially as high as third or fourth, so they are really going to count on him to have a big-time step forward, and maybe that surge that he had in the postseason, and he had a terrific September as well, will carry over into this year. He's going to shift to right field and play that full time. So hopefully the fact that he's bounced around the outfield a little bit at times will allow him to focus on one position and avoid crashing into walls as he did a couple of years ago. But if he can stay healthy and play 150 games, the hope is that he can put a 30-homer season up there and really carry the middle of that lineup.
A lot more we could talk about regarding these Nationals. Bottom line is this team is loaded. Other than injuries, Dave, as we wrap up, is there, in your mind, any one area of concern, one thing that can get in the way of this team winning 90-plus games again and having a legitimate shot at winning a World Series?
Well, you know, I mean, I look back, Glenn, at a couple of years ago. In 2012, they were so close, and they had the Strasburg shutdown and lost the heartbreaker. Well, going into 2013, everyone predicted the Nationals to run away with the division, and most picked them to win the National League or the World Series. And what happened that year? Well, they got out of the gate slow and never recovered, played well in the second half. But there are no guarantees. You know, and I hope, as we've talked about with this free agency looming over a bunch of key players, this is kind of this last go-around. I mean, I think the team will still be very competitive and very good, but this group of guys, this is kind of the last go-around. And is there an extra pressure added to that, not to mention the bullseye is going to be on you with being the prohibitive favorite? Does that focus... is that focus going to be there, or does it become a distraction going forward into the season? And obviously, health is the big equalizer. 2013, they had some key injuries in the first half, didn't overcome it. Last year, they had a ton of injuries early, but did overcome it. So it's a long journey, and again, they feel like they're covered as far as depth if a couple of players go down. But that's the fascinating part. You win the division by 17 games last year. Everyone thinks you look great on paper, but the cliche is you start 0-0. They don't start with a 17-game lead. Everyone's on level footing come April the 4th.
Some great insight on the Nats. Dave, thanks for the time. Survive the snow.
All right. We'll see you soon down in Florida. Looking forward to spring training.
We'll see you in Vieira. That's Dave Jagler, one of the radio voices of the Washington Nationals, with some terrific information on the team that the Marlins and everybody else are chasing in the National League East. When we come back, Kyle Seeloff takes us behind the scenes into the life of a Major League umpire, with longtime umpire and current MLB umpire observer, Steve Ripley. It's a fascinating conversation, and it's coming up next on Marlins Hot Stove.
Marlins Baseball Hot Stove Talk with Glenn Geffner is on 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Coming up later on our program tonight, going to talk with Justin Bour, Bohr made his big league debut in 2014. Looking forward to more from Justin Bohr in 2015. But before we get to Justin, it seems like the only time we talk about major league umpires is when we didn't think they did a very good job. It seems like the only time we talk about an umpire is when you're complaining. But as little as we talk about them, we hear from them even less. So great opportunity for Kyle Seeloff. He sat down with Steve Ripley, longtime big league umpire, 20 seasons in the big leagues, and now an umpire observer for Major League Baseball. He's at Marlins Park a lot over the course of the season. A very interesting conversation. Here's Kyle with Steve Ripley.
20-year Major League Baseball veteran umpire Steve Ripley with us on the Marlins Hot Stove Show tonight. Steve, thanks for taking the time. For 30 years of your life, 21 seasons in Major League Baseball, your profession was one not many people can say that they've held. When you were right, nobody had much to say, but when you were wrong, you were sure to hear about it. Before we chat about the life and daily routine of an umpire in Major League Baseball, take us back a little bit. When was it and what was it that made you want to become an umpire?
I believe in ninth grade, I had met a couple guys that were working in A-ball, professional A-ball down in this area, and also they worked up in the Tampa St. Pete area. Kind of put that in the back of my mind. During high school, I turned on the lights, lined the fields, kept score, and then if the umpire didn't show up, then I was the guy that had the umpire. So for playing sports most of my whole life, younger life, you know, I wasn't ever going to advance at any kind of professional level, so I always kept it in the back of my mind, possibly to become a professional and maybe possibly someday a major league umpire.
You retired in December of 2003. You umpired 2,514 regular season games. You worked four divisional series, three championship series, and three World Series, your last of those fall classics in 2001. Steve, the life of a Major League Baseball umpire, what's it like if you can put it into perspective for those that may not know?
Well, there's a lot of sacrifice that you go through as far as the family life. You're on the road approximately 6 months out of the year. You're living out of a suitcase. You're on a plane. You're moving every 3 to 4 days, and you're eating a lot of restaurant food. So you get to see a lot, but there's a lot of sacrifice that goes with the position.
I think we hear a lot about the grind players endure on a daily basis, but I'm sure umpires, to an extent, endure something similar. I'm sure this has changed over the years, but what's a typical day like for an umpire leading all the way up to like a 7-10 first pitch, we'll say?
All right, let's say it's the first game of the series. Our grind is a little bit maybe more so than a player because we don't really have a home base. But let's say we land that morning. We've caught it. We've already gotten up probably 5:30, 6 o'clock. We might land in the town 10:30, 11 o'clock. Grab our luggage, go check in, probably grab a quick lunch. Maybe do a little paperwork and put your head on the pillow for about an hour's nap. Then you get up and head to the ballpark about an hour 15, hour 30 early.
I talked to you just a couple of minutes ago. You had an opportunity to work three World Series, and your final was in 2001, just several months following the attacks, of course, on our country. It was the Yankees and the Diamondbacks. It went all seven games. Three of those games took place in New York. Can you put into perspective what that was like to be on the field in New York inside of Yankee Stadium as an umpire, and what was your reaction to hearing the news you had been selected to work that World Series?
Well, first off, I was hoping I didn't get picked for that series. But when I did, they picked me to be the crew chief, which means that I run the series. I get to work the plate game one behind the home plate, and then I've got game seven if it goes seven. But the whole thing surrounding 9/11 made it, just made it more of excitement than a regular World Series. And excitement might not be the right word, but there's right. a lot of surrounding things that were swirling around that World Series. But on the field, it seemed like it was an instant highlight tape because of the games that were in New York. I think they're all one runners, you know, going extra innings and that. But the other thing that went along with New York was when President Bush threw out the first ball. That seems to be a highlight on a lot of tapes that have been aired throughout the remainder since then.
I suppose it was games 3, 4, and 5 that were in Yankee Stadium. Game right. 3, before it all started, everything leading up to it, the anthem, the vibe in that stadium, what was that like?
Oh, it was just, it was amazing. I mean, if your hair never stands up on your arms there, it's never going to. We walked in the ballpark that night unannounced. There was a Secret Service guy that was in our dressing room dressed like us that was going to go on the field. And then we had the president that went by us. The whole story is true about that. He went by us and went to the Columbus room, which is the batting cage. He practiced throwing, then he came back by our room and talked to us about 20 minutes before we had to go on the field. And then the excitement of the actual first pitch when he nailed it for a strike was... it's just something you'll never forget.
I'm sure that's incredible. And as tough of a time as that was, I think, as we can all tell, it was an incredible experience for you personally, to say the least. Steve, switching gears a little bit, we have a chance to see you quite often at Marlins Park throughout the course of the season. And you've transitioned from the field to the press box, where you now evaluate current crews and umpires. What's that experience like? And can you give us a little insight as to what that entails?
Well, my job is kind of like an extra set of eyes for the office. I'll watch the game, and if everything goes smoothly and nothing happens that night, no situations, it's pretty much easy thing to do. But also along with that, when I watch a game the next day, they send me like 35, 40 film clips of every play, and I have to evaluate whether it was correct or incorrect. So I do a lot of film work the following the day of the night that before that I was at the stadium.
Former Major League Baseball umpire Steve Ripley with us on the Marlins Hot Stove Show. And Steve, I think as we can all tell, the game is frequently changing, it's progressing, and there's been a strong emphasis on simply getting all the calls right. When we talk about instant replay, it has unquestionably changed the game. Some would say for the better, others would say for the worse. But in your mind, given the technology that we have and what it has to offer in 2015, how important is it today's day and age to simply get the calls correct?
Well, from an umpire standpoint, you're being evaluated, and they're putting numbers on you. And the number that I've heard, I don't know it to be exactly right, but if you miss six or more calls, then your odds for landing a postseason assignment go down extremely. And so it's very, very important. I mean, there's always a pride factor and an embarrassment factor. So, it's a built-in mechanism for umpires to get things right. No one's just going to go out there and do their job, and if they miss it, they don't care about it and instant replay or correct it. There's still a pride factor, and there's still an embarrassment factor, and also there's a landing a postseason assignment factor.
I know you, in the off season, go to clinics. You see a lot of young people and maybe some older ones still looking to break into the big leagues or begin their umpiring careers. But is the art of umpiring now taught differently given how the game is being played and given the replay and new rules?
At the lower levels, I would say it's being the level of professional baseball they're going to enter into has nothing to do with what's going on in the big league level. Having said that, at the lower level, there's rookie ball and A ball are still working a two-man system, so that's basically what they're taught at umpire school. And as they advance through the levels, then they go into a three-man system. And then when they start actually changing a few things of what they do and all that, is at the AAA level in the Arizona Fall League.
I'll ask you this. I've heard that umpiring at the major league level is very similar to what a minor league baseball player endures. It can take years and years and years. On average, how many years do you think it takes for those that maybe want to do something with their profession like a major league baseball umpire?
To get to the major league level right now, I'm going to put an average, maybe 12 years on it. It varies from guy to guy, but the minor league system is built now that you go to each level and there's a retention program that you can stay there X amount of years and then advance. So I would say in the neighborhood of 11, 12 years before you get a shot at the big leagues.
I would say that maybe there's some young folks listening this evening and they would say, well, this is great. You're on the field with Major League Baseball umpires, but how do I even begin? Where do I do? Do I go to a little league program? Who do I talk to? For those, looking to get involved into umpiring, where do they even start?
Well, there's two schools that you can go to get in professional baseball. One is called the Umpire School, which is run by Minor League Baseball. And the other school that you can go to get in professional baseball, it's Harry Windelstedt School, which is run by his son, Hunter, now. So those two schools, you apply to go to those schools, and if you're accepted, then you go into a five-week course. After that five-week course, that sounds like a minimal amount of time, but after the five-week course, you go into an advanced 10-day course, and then outside, when you get out of that and you're ranked, let's say you're ranked, they rank them 1 through 40, there might be 40 guys they take to the advanced school. If there's 10 jobs open in minor league baseball, meaning rookie level, you know, at the bottom rungs, they'll take 10 guys. And then out of that 10 guys, probably 3 or 4 or 5 might quit in mid-season, and then they'll go to the list and start with, you know, 11 through 15 to fill the gap. So that's a process that keeps going. There's some guys that are at the higher level, double A and triple A, that they get to the point where they can see the handwriting on the wall, and they'll just release themselves. They'll retire.
Well, I think it's pretty amazing, and obviously that there's certainly a grind even in the minor leagues all the way up to the major league season. I'm sure you know all too well, on any given night, there are a lot of umpires in the stands, a lot of folks, they think they can do the job. The reality, they can't. But for those that have never been on the field during a game, just how fast is it, and how tough can it be to make a call on what we refer to as a bang-bang play?
Well, there's fundamentals of our job, just like any other job, but the bang-bang play that we're probably referring to is the ball getting the first base and the runner's foot hitting the bag. Our mechanics on that is that we listen for the ball and we watch the foot of the player. Everybody says, how can you hear that with the fans yelling and screaming? Well, it's an art, and you're right there, and it's just a fundamental and a procedure that that you use over and over, and it's probably one of our biggest thing in our foundation to get things right.
I know you.
That was Kyle Seeloff with Steve Ripley. Some interesting stuff from the Major League Baseball Umpire Observer. He's the guy who sits up in the press box every night and literally evaluates the umpires. And they go over video on a daily basis. They issue written reports on a daily basis. If you get frustrated in the stands by an umpire's call, there are nights where Steve Ripley will say, you know what, he was right. And he was in the right position. He made the right call. No matter what people say, no matter what the guys on the radio or on TV might have said, Steve Ripley's got a different vantage point and a different perspective on things. It's very interesting business, and it's not one that we hear a whole lot about. So some great insight there from Steve Ripley, and a terrific interview by Kyle Seeloff. So thanks to Kyle. Thanks to Steve Ripley. When we come back, going to continue what has been and what will continue to be a very busy 2 hours of Marlins talk here on this Monday night. When we return, going to catch up with Justin Bour, who made his big league debut in 2014. He's had a very interesting winter as well. We'll talk baseball. We'll talk about his visit to Southwest Asia with the Marlins family this offseason. Talk about his recent stint in Major League Baseball's rookie development program as well. A lot to get to with Justin Bour right after this, so stay with us on Marlins Hot Stove.
Baseball's burning questions all winter long. Winter long. Fire up the stove with the Marlins' Glenn Geffner on 940 Wins.
Right around third, Ozuna the throw to the plate, and Wright is out at the plate. Ozuna throws out the tying man for the second out of the eighth.
Miami Sports.
Bour, 6'4", 250, 26 years old. 25th round pick of the Cubs back in 09. He was called up to the big leagues yesterday. 5 seasons in the Cubs organization. Last 2 years, put up big numbers at Double-A Tennessee. Last 4 years, really good numbers overall as he chops one slowly past the pitcher's mound, charged by the second baseman. Zobrist won't have a play at first. It's an infield hit for Bour, his first hit in the big leagues. And now the Marlins have him loaded for the other rookie, JT Realmuto. 2-2 to Bour. Swinging a chopper first base side. That's into right field over the head of the first baseman, Loney. In from third to score McGee. Jones to third. It's the second hit and the first major league run batted in for Justin Bour. 9-5 Marlins. A couple of major league firsts from back on June the 5th in St. Pete for our next guest, Marlins first baseman Justin Bour, who we saw make his major league debut in 2014. Justin appeared in 39 games for Miami in between stints tearing it up at AAA New Orleans, and he joins us tonight. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, for folks who may not know your history, 5 seasons in the Cubs organization before coming to the Marlins in the minor league Rule 5 draft last winter with the Cubs. You'd had a 23-homer season in A-ball. You drove in 110 runs in a season at Double-A. You hit a lot of doubles, a career OPS up over 800. What was it like getting that fresh start with a new organization last year?
I mean, that was awesome, you know, getting that opportunity. My brother called me and he told me that I'd been picked up by the Marlins in Rule 5. I was pumped, you know. I enjoyed it.
and you really took advantage of the opportunity. While we didn't see you in big league camp last year, and you didn't start there on the 40-man roster, we were watching the big numbers you were putting up in New Orleans, and then in early June, you got the call to the big leagues for the first time. What do you remember about getting that news?
Just pretty much a rush of emotions. I didn't really see it coming. You know, all the guys were saying, you're probably going to get called up here pretty soon, but, you know, I know how it works with, you know, not being on the 40-man and all that stuff. So when I got the call, I wasn't really expecting it, but it was obviously something I'm never going to forget.
When you first came up, we were in the middle of a stretch of interleague games in AL Park, so you were able to DH a few times. You had two hits in your big league debut at Tampa Bay. You had a three-hit game at Texas against the Rangers. But then we got back to regular NL games, and most of your at-bats came off the bench, one every few days. When you're just getting acclimated to the major leagues, and when you've always been accustomed to getting four at-bats a night as a starter, how challenging is it to suddenly be getting just one shot every few days, often with a game on the line in the eighth inning and somebody throwing 98 miles per hour?
Obviously, it's a tough situation. I think it's funny you're playing the Rays game on the radio. I heard that a little before I got on. It was the sweet choppers that I had to second base for base hits. And not really how I thought my first major league hit was going to go. But, like you said, it's
they were
it's
line
a
drives.
Tough thing.
Don't believe the guy on the radio.
It looks like a line drive in the box.
Exactly.
But like you're saying, it's a tough thing to do to come in and pinch it right away when you don't know the league. But I felt like the more I started to see you guys and kind of take in the information I was getting from other players, you know, how to go about pinch hitting and stuff like that, and that was a big help for me. And as it went on, I felt like I got better and more comfortable at it and sort of learned my routine, so that was good.
I want to ask you about that process and what you learned, because with Michael Morse brought in to play first base this season, it seems like your best shot this spring is going to be as a lefty bat off the bench. You can spell Morse from time to time and step in to start when needed. But what did you learn over the course of the season last year that you think helps you out coming into 2015? That's a tough role to be in for any player, let alone a young player.
Right. It's just a matter of seeing these pitchers. I felt like when I saw a pitcher for the second time, I was better. Reed Johnson was a big help to me as far as kind of watching what he did and talking to other hitters who have done the pinch hitting thing. And even Jones talked about how, you know, when he was first coming up, he'd do some pinch hitting. So, all those guys were a big help for me, and it's kind of, you know, helped me to create my own plan. But it's just a matter of seeing those guys enough. You can watch all the film in the world, but once you got to see that, you know, 98 two-seamer to really understand exactly what you're getting into. So I think the more that I do it, the better I'm going to get.
You got to step into the box. It's not just about watching video, not just about somebody telling you what somebody throws. You've got to stand in there and do it for yourself.
Right, that's just it's a learning curve as well. You know, you go from starting every day, and I've never been a bench player. I'm used to starting and batting fourth every day, so it's just a different role for me and a way to help the team. So, you know, that's what I want to do.
What's your off-season routine like, getting ready for the start of spring training? I know you're up near Washington, D.C. You're not in Siberia, but you may not be able to be outside on a daily basis. What do you do to get through the winter?
I'm able to go up to George Mason, where I went to college, and I can do the hitting and throwing and stuff like that. And then a couple of days a week, I'll go to the end zone and do my, you know, speed and agility training. But I've been pretty busy this offseason, actually, with a lot of other stuff going on.
I want to ask you about some of those things. You've had, from where I'm sitting, maybe the most interesting offseason of just about anybody on this Marlins ball club. So we're going to take a real quick break now. When we come back with Justin Bour, we want to talk about the winter. It's been a fun one. And we'll get into it right after this. Stay with us, talking Marlins baseball up until 9 o'clock tonight. It's Marlins Hot Stove on 940 Wins.
Baseball's Hot Stove season is here. The Marlins' Glenn Geffner is on 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Here's Justin Bour, who drove in the lone Marlins run with a ground out. There's a high drive off Bour's bat. Long way deep to right center field. And for Justin Bour, his first major league home run. He hit it off the facade of the home run porch to pull the Marlins back within a run at 3-2. Justin Bour, the minor league veteran, put up big numbers in Double-A and Triple-A in the Cubs and Marlins organizations in recent years, and he just got into one against Fister and launches his first ever major league long ball. Back with you on Marlins Hot Stove, talking Marlins baseball up until 9 o'clock tonight. In the second half of this hour, we will have some time to take your phone calls. If you want to jump online, talk some baseball, Marlins baseball, Major League Baseball, you have questions, you have concerns, you have thoughts on some of what we've heard from the new commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, in the last couple of days. What do you think about the possibility of a pitch clock in the major leagues? What do you think about the possibility of discussions about banning defensive shifts on the infield, something that the commissioner suggested he's contemplating yesterday? Why don't you jump online? We're going to take some phone calls in the second half of this 8 o'clock hour, 866-801-0940. The number to call, 866-801-0940. If you want to talk some Marlins baseball, whatever questions you have, whatever comments you have, thoughts on the offseason to this point, thoughts on what's left for Michael Hill and Dan Jennings to accomplish, let us know. As here we sit now, just a few weeks away from the start of spring training, February 20th, the first pitchers and catchers workout. Hey, don't forget, now's the time to lock in your 2015 season seats at Marlins Park. Season ticket plans start at just $380. You can take advantage of the new $15 per game full season plan with great seat locations and a free Marlins jersey for every two seats purchased. Place your deposit today and start enjoying all of the savings and benefits of being a Marlins season ticket holder. Number to call, 1-877-MARLINS. Again, that number is 1-877-MARLINS, or you can go online to marlins.com/2015tickets. And again, earlier in the show, we mentioned that Marlins winter warm-up event coming up on Saturday, February 21st. You can head out to the ballpark. You can purchase single game tickets for the first time. And if you're thinking about season tickets, you can try them on for size at the ballpark that day as well. All the information at marlins.com. I want to get back to our conversation with Marlins first baseman Justin Bour. And Justin, I think we lost you there for a minute, so you missed it. You had lamented in our last segment that your first big league hit was a chopper on the infield. So we came back into this segment with your first major league home run, September 19th. You hit it off Doug Fister. That's got to be a feeling that as a kid, you grow up swinging a bat in the backyard. You play high school ball, college ball at George Mason. You come up through the minor leagues. Tell me about hitting your first big league home run and what that experience was like for you.
That was a pretty cool experience for me. You know, that's what you always dream of doing. It was pretty cool that I did it against the hometown team, you know, where I'm from in the D.C. area. So obviously all my friends were like, what are you doing, man? Come on, like against the Nats, why? So that was fun. It was pretty cool.
Before we get to your offseason, I want to ask you about living up in that area because the Marlins seem to be the team in the NL East stepping forward this winter, looking to make a run at those Nationals who most around the country think are invincible and a team that's going to run away with the National League East, maybe win a World Series this year. What are you hearing from your friends, your buddies up there, Nationals fans, about what the Marlins have done this winter?
I mean, everyone's impressed with what the Marlins have done, not just the Nationals fans. I think, you know, it's pretty obvious news that the Marlins have done some serious work this offseason, and everyone's, you know, really excited to get back and get the season started to see all that stuff that's happened in the offseason, you know, take place on the field.
Be fun to go home and play in a pennant race in your hometown in September this year, wouldn't it?
That'd be awesome.
It'd be a cool way to wrap the season up. Hey, let's talk about your offseason. You, Chris Hatcher, who was a Marlin when the trip began but became a Dodger by the time it was over, Preston Wilson, several of the Marlins front office staff members. You spent a week in December in Southwest Asia visiting U.S. troops. It was the Marlins' sixth Armed Forces Entertainment Tour since they began what's just been a remarkable program back in 2010. They went to Iraq and Kuwait back in 2010. For folks who didn't follow your tour online, where'd you guys get to visit?
We went to Qatar, Oman, and Abu Dhabi. We flew through Dubai on one of the trips, so we got to see the Dubai airport, which is, I mean, pretty incredible. So those are the three spots we went to.
I know in talking to players who've made these trips in the past, they just can't say enough about the experience. What were some of the highlights of the trip for you?
Well, actually, it's the first time I've actually fell asleep on an airplane. So that was a big thing for me. You know, I'm a bigger guy. And I don't really fit in the airplanes that well. So I had one of the seats that, you know, had a little bit of leg room. So I got to sleep. So that was a big plus for me. But, you know, as far as the trip goes, that's something that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life. You know, getting to see those men and women who, you know, do so much for us and, you know, protect us while we're here playing the game. You can't thank them enough. So once I got that invitation to go, I jumped all over that. For me, the highlights, just talking with the guys, you know, while we were over there. They're all normal people. It was pretty cool on the first trip that we went two in Qatar, they went off base and they were actually able to get some food that wasn't in the chow hall for them. So they were excited, but it was pretty cool to see how they were always on. You know, they, once they got back in the base, it was, you know, all seriousness, and we kind of got to live that life for a little bit and see what they go through. I mean, some of those guys, Air Force people are 12 hours on, 12 hours off shifts. So it was pretty intense.
The thing that players so often say after these trips is, we go over there to say thank you to these servicemen and women and to bring them a slice of home at the other side of the world. And yet when it's all over, guys often say they feel like they got every bit as much out of the experience as the servicemen and women did. Is that how you felt about it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's one of those very unique opportunities. And I would imagine when you got the call from the Marlins inviting you on this trip, you know, the off season is not as long as everybody would like. You got a lot going on. You've got family time you're trying to catch up on. You've got off season routines you want to work your way through. Was it an easy decision for you to go?
For me, it was, yeah. My parents ingrained in my mind since I was younger, you know, to give back and do anything you can to help, especially like in the community. You know, I was fortunate enough to make the big leagues this year, and, you know, I want to do positive things with that. So once I got the email asking if I wanted to go, it was kind of a no-brainer. You know, it was something I wanted to do, but also I felt like it was the right thing to do.
And if I'm not mistaken, you had a grandfather who served in Korea, right?
Yes.
Was that part of the motivation?
A little bit. Yeah, I think it all goes into it. You know, you can't really thank those guys enough.
You got to see, I would imagine, some pretty amazing things technologically when you were over there. What are some of the opportunities that really stand out?
The airplanes, obviously, were incredible. Just blown away by that. Some of the size of these anti-mine gun or anti-mine vehicles were incredible too. Just the sheer size of them. I posted one of the pictures on, I forget, Instagram or Twitter, but one of my buddies was like, look at the size of that car compared to you. And you look at it, and I was like a fifth of that car, and I'm a pretty big guy, so that was cool. Those were ones sticking out to me right now, just the planes and the vehicles and, you know, all the weapons.
And then in the middle of this trip, Chris Hatcher is traded to the Los Angeles Dodgers. That had to make for an interesting second part of the trip.
Yes, it did. I got some text messages when I got off the plane. My girlfriend sent me. She's like, Hatcher just got traded. And so I'm like, hey, Hatch, you got your phone? He goes, no, why? I go, because you just got traded. He goes, no way. He goes, wow. I told my wife when I was leaving for this trip that I will get traded. I was probably going to get traded. So that was pretty incredible.
Wow.
And then, I mean, he did a pretty solid thing by staying on and you know, continuing the rest of the trip.
Mm-hmm. Have you been able to stay in contact with anybody that you met overseas? Are you, whether it's through email or Twitter or anything, staying in touch?
Yeah. I sent those guys, I gave a couple guys my email and Twitter, but I imagine they're pretty busy. So I'm looking to hear back from them, you know, once they get back.
What an amazing experience. Now, more recently, you had the chance to attend the MLB Rookie Development Program. And for folks who might not know, every year, Major League Baseball hosts some of the top prospects in the game for a four-day crash course about life in the big leagues. What was that experience like for you?
That was a good experience as well. It's just a little bit of everything. A little bit more than we get in spring training as far as media, you know, talking to them and all the different things, the Players Association, and that sort of thing. So that was a good trip as well. Like you said, it's been a very busy offseason.
For sure. What were some of the points of emphasis? You mentioned dealing with the media is one thing, but what other sorts of things are important that Major League Baseball tries to push across as points of emphasis to young players getting to the big leagues for the first time?
You talked about that influx of money that you guys are getting once you make it, and you know, you might have family members that are asking for money or friends and all the stuff that sort of comes along with being a major leaguer. So they had a skit group come and kind of work through with the players some different things and how to deal with it and just sort of what to expect, really. A lot of stuff I'd heard before, during this weekend. I was fortunate in the Cubs organization; they did a pretty good job of going over a lot of this stuff. But some of the stuff was pretty new, learning to deal with your finances, your 401k, and all that stuff. So I mean, it was good.
Wrapping up with Justin Bour. Justin, you just mentioned the Cubs again one more time. Big loss for the Cubs family, big loss for Major League Baseball, Ernie Banks passing away over the weekend. In your years with the Cubs at spring training in the minor leagues, did you ever get a chance to cross paths with Mr. Cub?
No, I didn't know.
It was a sad day when the news broke. I think it was Friday night that Ernie Banks, the great Hall of Famer, had passed away. Before we let you go, Justin, everybody's talking about the Super Bowl. You got the Pats, you got the Seahawks. You a football guy, and you have a pick on this one?
Well, I'm a Redskins fan, but they didn't even come close. So I guess I would go with the Patriots, I think, because that's my family would rather. I think my dad doesn't like the Seahawks, but I think go with the Patriots.
Sounds good. Well,
or maybe it's wrong. I'll probably go downstairs after this, and they'll be all mad at me for saying the wrong team or whatever. I'll go Patriots.
That's all right. Hey, Justin, thank you for taking the time tonight, and we'll look forward to seeing you in Jupiter in just a few weeks.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That's Justin Bour, Marlins first baseman, our guest on Marlins Hot Stove. Some good insight from a young man who is hoping to break through and earn a spot on this ball club this spring. We saw him for 39 games last year. He's an intriguing player, and I used the word intriguing about Justin Bour on several occasions, I think, on the air over the course of last season. Left-handed bat with some power, put up huge numbers in the minor leagues at every stop, and when he got a chance to play on a somewhat regular basis, even when it just meant getting a start or two in a row and getting four at-bats or six or eight at-bats in the span of a couple of days, you saw what Justin Bour can do with the bat. And for a big guy, he mentioned the fact that he's 6'4", 250 pounds. For a big guy, he also more than held his own defensively at first base, did a real nice job with the glove. And he was a guy who I thought maybe would have seen a little bit more of even down the stretch last year than we did. I got a chance to play, had some big hits for the Marlins in September. Had some big hits when he was up earlier in the season as well. But a very intriguing player, and we'll see how things play out here for him in 2015. Obviously, you go into the season, everybody's healthy. Michael Morse will be this team's first baseman, but you wouldn't be at all surprised to see Justin Bour making a contribution off the bench. Big lefty bat, a power threat. We now believe it's not official. There hasn't been an announcement from the Marlins yet, but we now believe that Ichiro Suzuki is going to be on this ball club in 2015. We'll talk about Ichiro in our final half hour a little bit. He's a lefty bat coming off the bench, but Bour, who plays first base, does a nice job with the glove, a guy who I would anticipate you're going to see a lot of here in 2015, and we're grateful for him taking some time with us here on the show tonight. Now, when we come back, the rest of the show belongs to you. If you'd like to jump on the phone lines, 866-801-0940 is the number to call, 866-801-0940. 0940. If you want to talk some baseball, whatever's on your mind tonight, give me a yell. If we have the opportunity, we're going to talk about some of these time of game, pace of game issues, defensive shifts. Might they go away? I mentioned Ichiro's name. Get to some of the other news today across Major League Baseball as we continue 30 minutes to go here on Marlins Hot Stove. Now's the time if you want to jump online. 866-801-0940, the number to call. We'll talk with you when we come back on 940 Wins.
Keep your hand on the hot stove with the Marlins' Glenn Geffner. 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Well, the hot stove season is winding down. 10 weeks from today, opening day, April 6th against the Atlanta Braves. April 6th, an important date to have on your calendar. February 20th, an important date to have on your calendar. That's when Marlins pitchers and catchers have their first workout up at Roger Dean Stadium in Jupiter. A couple of other important dates we've mentioned earlier in the show. Want to reinforce this one. It's a big day. February 21st, it's a Saturday, the 2015 Marlins winter warm-up at Marlins Park. We've been talking about this date throughout this hot stove show that got started all the way back in November. And in November and December, it felt like it was forever away. But it's coming up quickly. Saturday, February 21st, bring your whole family out to the ballpark. A lot of fun over the course of the day at Marlins Park. You can purchase single-game tickets for the 2015 season for the first time, opening day tickets, whatever opponents you want to come out and see. Get your single-game tickets for the first time at winter warm-up on February 21st. You can select your seats for season tickets and mini plans. Get autographs from Marlins players and alumni. Enjoy games, activities, music, and entertainment for all ages. I'll be out there as well. Hopefully get a chance to say hello face-to-face. Don't miss Marlins winter warm-up coming up Saturday, February 21st at Marlins Park. For more information, go to marlins.com. And I want to also remind you about the Jack McKeon Celebrity Golf Classic. It'll be held at the Crandon Golf at Key Biscayne on Wednesday, February 18th. Foursomes, individual spots, and sponsorship opportunities already available. Join Marlins players, coaches, executives, and other celebrities for a fun day of golf at the luxurious Crandon Golf Course overlooking Biscayne Bay in downtown Miami. Again, 1-877-MARLINS or marlins.com/golf. For more information, the Jack McKeon Celebrity Golf Classic right around the corner coming up on Wednesday, February 18th. All your favorite Marlins players are out at that terrific event every year as well. If you want to jump online, 866-801-0940, the number to call. Talk some baseball tonight, 866-801-0940. I would be remiss if I failed to mention that Major League Baseball has got a new commissioner as of yesterday. Bud Selig is retired after 22 years. Selig presided over record revenues for the sport and an unprecedented run of labor peace. He saw 22 new ballparks built on his watch and, among other things, introduced the wild card, divisional realignment, interleague play, and instant replay, as well as the toughest performance-enhancing drug testing in American sports. Selig leaves that legacy now to the new commissioner, Rob Manfred, his longtime lieutenant who was elected over the summer by Major League owners. He officially took office yesterday. There's been a lot of talk about the new commissioner's priorities. He has talked about aggressively supporting amateur baseball, the idea being that more kids should play the sport, hopefully helping solidify the next generation of baseball fans. He'd also like to see the best young athletes stick with baseball through high school, college, and into the professional ranks rather than choosing to play other sports. In recent interviews he's done, he has given us some other insights into how he thinks on various topics. The new commissioner says he doesn't envision the DH being removed in the AL or being added in the NL. Looks like the status quo for the DH. He's in favor of continuing to determine home field advantage for the World Series through the outcome of the All-Star game. I don't know. Public sentiment, I would say, is mixed at best on that Bud Selig idea. He's opposed to ads on Major League uniforms. I think most would agree that that's a good idea. I don't want to turn a Major League uniform into a NASCAR fire suit. The new commissioner says he doesn't see expansion in baseball's immediate future. He does think an international draft is inevitable. It's only a question of when. The new commissioner won't rule out day games in the World Series moving forward. I think that's a great idea, particularly when you talk about trying to excite more young fans about the game. It's been a frustration of mine for years that I have a tough time staying up to watch most of the postseason games, and my kids have no chance. They've got to get up and go to school in the morning. For folks who've got to get up and go to work in the morning, it's tough to stay up night after night and watch postseason games when you've got the long, now expanded playoffs that begin in early October and sometimes run into November. It's tough to do that night after night. Every now and then, it would be nice to see some day games in the postseason, particularly for the kids, particularly during the World Series. I think the last time there was a day game played in the World Series might have been 1987, but don't hold me to that. I think 87 was the year. But the new commissioner says, well, it's a possibility it would bring back a day game or two in the World Series moving forward. We'll see. He has yet to look at the situation closely enough to have an opinion on the possibility of Pete Rose being reinstated in the game. That's something to keep an eye on over the course of the next year, particularly with the All-Star game in Cincinnati in 2015. And the Reds, you would imagine, would want to have Pete Rose involved one way or another. New commissioners addressed a lot of topics since his election was made official, but there is one that seems to be getting the most attention, and I want to talk about it a little bit here tonight. I'd love for you to chime in if you have an opinion as well. 866-801-0940, the number to call. The new commissioner has made picking up the pace of play priority number one. He wants faster games, thinking the longer games that have been played in recent years are a deterrent to attracting new fans and are potentially discouraging existing fans from coming out to the ballpark or watching games on TV, listening on the radio. Look, I agree there are certain things we can do to speed up games. You can keep the hitter in the batter's box during at-bats. You can limit coaches, managers, and catchers' visits to the mound. You can speed up instant replay. You can require relief pitchers to get into the game more quickly. If you really wanted to shave off some significant time, how about 9 minutes of ball game? You could cut out 30 seconds between every half inning of the game and have TV maybe get creative with occasional on-screen advertising to make up for the one missed commercial during each break if you shave 30 seconds off those between inning breaks. You watch the World Cup and there are no commercial interruptions at all except at halftime, and you can't tell me the TV's not a big part of the World Cup. But when you start talking about radically changing the on-field product, and I'm talking specifically about the possibility of putting a pitch clock on the field and punishing pitchers who don't make a pitch within an allotted period of time, well, that's where I think people get a little bit nervous. Now, I was really intrigued to hear the Marlins pitching coach, Chuck Hernandez, come out as a supporter of the pitch clock earlier on our show tonight. I said, damn, it's not that big a deal. He likes when pitchers work quickly. We all do. He encourages his pitchers to work quickly. We all love to see that. But he says, no, he doesn't think it would be that big a deal. Now, as you probably know, they tried out a 20-second pitch clock in the Arizona Fall League this winter. That same pitch clock is going to be implemented in AA and AAA this season. There is no pitch clock coming to MLB yet, but the new commissioner recently said that when it comes to speeding up the game, some change is definitely on the way.
Yeah, we think that the results of the experiments in the Arizona Fall League were very positive. We're going to be working closely with Tony Clark and the people at the Players Association. I am 100% certain that we're going to have pace of play changes for this year. It may be a multi-year set of changes. Again, things on the field, when we go, we want to make sure we have them right. But we are going to make progress on that issue this year.
That's the new baseball commissioner, Rob Manfred. So what specifically those changes will be, we don't know yet. Remember, the commissioner can't do anything unilaterally. Owners, general managers, managers, and perhaps most importantly, the Players Association are all going to have to sign off on anything that's going to be done. But like the new commissioner, Hall of Fame manager Joe Torre, who now oversees on-field operations for MLB, agrees that some kind of change is coming.
You know, I think what we're looking at now in regards to pace of game is strictly pace of game. You know, not necessarily length of game, although that would pick up if you helped the pace. You know, I was never a proponent of introducing the clock in baseball, but I went out there the one afternoon and I was pretty impressed. It was there, but it really wasn't intrusive in any way. I think the clock worked in that environment. I'm not discounting down the road that it may be a benefit or... But I was very surprised that it really didn't stand out for me, which is good. You know, we've been into this phrase of that's the way we've always done it stuff, and I understand it. Change is going to have to, I think, be done with the understanding, and you can't say this is what we're going to do because the players play the game, and we want to make sure that. You know, we're not disrupting what they do, you know, but I think there's still some time in there or still some dead time in there that we can pick up.
Now, there's Hall of Famer Joe Torre with what sounded like an endorsement potentially of a pitch clock down the road. We got the endorsement from Chuck Hernandez early in the show tonight. Would love to know what you think. Again, I'm all for shortening the break between innings. I'm all for eliminating wasted time wherever possible. I also think, though, the part of the beauty of baseball is the fact that unlike any other sport, it's not governed in any way by a clock. The last thing I want to do as a broadcaster is sit in the radio booth and count down a pitch clock the way you count down a shot clock in basketball or a play clock in football. And based on a poll I put up on social media and based on the comments many of you sent me on Facebook and Twitter when I brought the subject up a few days ago, I get the sense that the vast majority of you guys agree. I put up a poll last week on a polling app I've begun to use, and I asked, how big a problem do you consider the length of Major League Baseball games to be? I gave you three choices. One, something must be done immediately. Two, MLB has bigger fish to fry. Or three, I love MLB and I couldn't care less. 83% of the people who responded said either they couldn't care less or MLB has bigger fish to fry. 52%, more than half, said they couldn't care less. Only 17%, essentially one out of every six people who voted in this very unscientific poll, said something must be done immediately. And if I turn to Facebook and Twitter, virtually every single response I received said something along the lines of, I'm not worried about the length of baseball games. Your responses really have reaffirmed what I believe, which is that people who love the game don't care much, if at all. People at the ballpark appreciate the pace of baseball. I've said this over and over in the past. No one complains about a good movie that lasts over 3 hours. No one complains that the last 3 minutes of an NBA game seem to take 30 minutes to play. No one complains that NFL games are longer than Major League Baseball games. And I just read the other day, a study was done looking very closely at NFL games, and what they found was only 8% of the time of an NFL game is actually taken up by game action. I understand there are some extreme baseball games out there that can really drag on, but I think, and it looks like the fans I hear from agree, there are other things that can be done to speed games up rather than add a pitch clock, for example. And there are certainly other things that ought to be higher on MLB's list of priorities moving forward. That's my thought. We'd love to get yours. 866-801-0940, the number to call. When we come back, we'll get to your phone calls. If you want to chime in, we'll look at what some of you had to say on Facebook and Twitter on this issue as well. Talk a little bit about Ichiro Suzuki, some of the other news of the day in Major League Baseball. We're down to our final 10-15 minutes, so stay with us on Marlins Hot Stove.
Baseball's burning questions all winter long. Fire up the stove with the Marlins' Glenn Geffner on 940 Wins.
Right around third, Ozuna the throw to the plate, and Wright is out at the plate! Ozuna throws out the tying man for the second out of the eighth.
Miami Sports.
I would say you guys agree on the potential for a pitch clock. No clock is what I'm hearing loud and clear on Facebook and Twitter from folks out there. Just heard from Cliff on Facebook saying, no clock. We love being at the park and the pace of the game. Robert says, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Baseball is more popular than ever. Greg says, no problem here. Jonathan says, I don't think it's a problem at all. I don't mind speeding up between innings, but time pitches is taking it too far. Players shouldn't feel rushed. Juan says, like a fine wine, baseball can't be rushed. Steve posted that one of the things he loves about baseball is it's the only sport without a clock. He says he's never understood complaints about the length of games. Dan says the same thing about the lack of a clock being part of the beauty of baseball, though he thinks the game could be sped up if you eliminated some of the pitcher-catcher conferences. Our buddy Joel from Australia, who is a loyal listener to this show and a big Marlins fan out in Australia. We love hearing from Joel. He says, if the game ain't broke, don't try to fix it. He's a stickler for tradition. And while he's at it, he adds that the Buster Posey rule ought to be abolished before they worry about the time of game. I think many would agree with that sentiment from Joel. I could go on and on, but I think you get the point. The funny thing is, this is how all of us feel. This is certainly how the Twitter sphere feels. This is how the fans feel. And yet we've heard tonight, live from Chuck Hernandez, the Marlins pitching coach, and I played you that cut from the Hall of Fame manager, Joe Torre, who oversees on-field operations for Major League Baseball, and both of them are okay with the clock. And you heard Chuck say he would imagine the most pitchers would be okay with the clock. He likes pitchers to work fast, likes them to get into that rhythm and routine. I forwarded a Q&A that appeared on minorleaguebaseball.com a couple of days ago, put it out on Twitter and Facebook, a conversation with the Marlins' AAA manager, Andy Haynes, who is heading into his second year at the helm of the New Orleans Zephyrs. And he talked about the pitch clock from a unique perspective. He managed in the Arizona Fall League this winter. He managed with that pitch clock in the Fall League, and he was not a fan. And if you want to check my Twitter feed or my Facebook page, you can read his comments in their entirety. But he said there are shades of gray. There are times when that clock starts when the catcher throws the ball back to the pitcher, but the ball rolls away from the pitcher, and the pitcher's got to run it down and get back on the mound. You got to rush. There are times when catchers and pitchers just can't get on the same page. And he said, no, there really weren't a lot of problems in the Fall League, but the Fall League is the Fall League. It's essentially exhibition-type baseball. It's not a double-A or triple-A game where wins and losses matter to players and managers. And it certainly isn't a major league game where there's so much at stake. So it's interesting, and we'll see how this plays out over the course of the next few years. We do know there will be pitch clocks for all double-A and triple-A games here in 2015. And it sounds, the more and more you hear from people in baseball, as though it may inevitably become a Major League Baseball before too long. As Chuck Hernandez said, look, they wouldn't be experimenting with it at AA and AAA if they didn't think the major leagues were going to be next. Want to also address something the commissioner said yesterday. He said while the pace of play is priority number one, he said he'd also like to restore some of the offense to the game. And one of the things we've heard a lot about is how offense has been down in recent years post-PEDs. You've got these new defensive alignments, defensive shifts that have really become in vogue in recent years. And he said he would consider banning defensive shifts, which is, again, he's not saying he's going to do it. He said it's something they'll talk about. It's something that hasn't even been tossed around yet with the higher-ups who need to make final calls on things. I would imagine the majority of general managers across baseball, the majority of managers would be against that move. Certainly those who represent the clubs that are very aggressive in shifting and trying to minimize what the opposing offense can do based on the data that you collect over years and years and years, careful study. We talked to Perry Hill on this show. The Marlins infield coach just a couple of weeks ago about all the work that goes into positioning defensive players. And I think, initially when this interview that he did with ESPN came out yesterday where the commissioner said he considered banning shifts, people said, wait a minute, how can you say that an infielder can't play in against D. Gordon or you can't play back against Giancarlo Stanton? I don't think that's what the commissioner's saying. I think the point most likely is there could at some point be a rule where you've got to have two infielders between first base and second base and two infielders between second base and third base. You can shade hitters. You just can't shift with three or four men on one side of the infield. Again, some smart people have found ways to try to slow down offense, and there's a chance that Major League Baseball might step in and say, no more. We'll see. Looking ahead to the week for the Marlins, we could get an official announcement from the club this week about the signing of Ichiro Suzuki. It's been reported that a deal's been agreed to, but a physical is pending. Ichiro, boy, you talk about the best outfield in baseball, as Buster Olney called it recently on ESPN.com. Giancarlo in right field, Marcelo Ozuna in center, Christian Yelich in left. Now you add Ichiro, a fourth outfielder, 14 big league seasons, a 10-time All-Star, a 10-time Gold Glove Award winner, a 317 career hitter, a 360 lifetime OBP, 10 seasons, 200 or more hits, including a major league record, 262 hits back in 04, 10 seasons, 30-plus stolen bases. Now, granted, he's 41 years old, but the Marlins aren't looking for Ichiro to go out there and play 150 games. He played 143 games, a career low for the Yankees this past season at 284, 324 OBP, stole 15 bases. So, again, this isn't the Ichiro from 2000, 2002, 2004, but still a very good player. Last year for the Yankees, 86 starts in right field, 6 in left field, 2 in center field. He can play all three outfield positions. Not a guy you're probably going to run out there as a center fielder on a regular basis if you had an injury. The Marlins, if Ozuna were to go down, could slide Christian Yelich over to center field and put Ichiro on left. What a terrific pickup, though, as a fourth outfielder, a left-handed bat off the bench for the Marlins. Can give Stanton, Ozuna, and Yelich the occasional day off, and we would anticipate that signing becoming official at some point this week. Some other major league notes today. The Reds have agreed to a four-year, $28 million contract extension with catcher Devin Mesoraco. This is one of those deals with a young arbitration-eligible player that you see from time to time along the lines of something the Marlins could do with a Christian Yelich or Marcelo Ozuna in the next year or two. Those players not even arbitration-eligible yet, but what the Reds do with this deal is they buy out all 3 years of Mesoraco's arbitration and his first year of free agency. Mesoraco, 26 years old, was a first-time All-Star in 2014, hit .273 for the Reds, led all big league catchers with 25 homers, drove in 80 runs for Cincinnati. So Devin Mesoraco, four-year, $28 million extension from the Reds. Former Marlins catcher, on the subject of catchers, John Buck has agreed to a minor league deal with the Atlanta Braves. Buck will serve as insurance for the Braves, who are counting on rookie Christian Betancourt and veteran A.J. Pierzynski to hold down the fort behind the plate. Remember, Braves traded Evan Gattis to Houston earlier this month. Evan Gattis has taken over for Brian McCann behind the plate. McCann leaving last winter to sign a free agent deal with the Yankees. John Buck, 34 years old, a Marlin in 2011 and 2012, headed to the Braves now on a minor league deal. We could see John Buck in 2015. That's going to do it for this week's show. I want to thank my guests tonight, Chuck Hernandez, Justin Bourne, Dave Jagler. Thanks to Kyle Seelaw for his terrific interview with Steve Ripley. Thanks also to our in-studio engineer, Mike Lacomiak. And again, thanks to you for joining us for another edition of Marlins Hot Stove. If you missed any of tonight's show, or if you'd like to go back and listen to past shows, all of our Marlins Hot Stove shows are available online at marlins.com/hotstove. They're also available as free podcasts on the iTunes Store. Tonight's show ought to be up at some point tomorrow afternoon. Don't forget, back with another 2 hours of baseball talk next Monday night at 7. We're going to have more Marlins talk, more Marlins guests. When it comes to the Marlins, keep your radio dial locked right here on your home for Marlins baseball all season and all off-season long. Miami Sports Station, 940 Wins.